From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. This hour may not be appropriate for all listeners. It's upsetting, and it should be upsetting. We're taking time to talk about a Grammy-winning superstar performer with a silky voice, a man whose ballads powered many a high school graduation and church service, a chart-topping sensation. We're talking about the R&B superstar R. Kelly, and we're talking about the devastation he has wrought, according to woman after woman who has surfaced with accusations he compelled them to have sex with him underage, accusations of being manipulated, accusations of being brainwashed. Yet most of this is not new. In fact, it started decades ago. A new Lifetime documentary has refocused our attention on Kelly's behavior. So why did it take so long for us to pay attention? Why did we turn away? This hour on Point, R. Kelly and ourselves. Join us. Given what we now know about R. Kelly, or at least what we're learning, how does that change how you think about him and his music? And what did you think about the Lifetime documentary? You can join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. With us from Culver City, California, is Dream Hampton. She's a writer and a filmmaker and the executive producer of the new Lifetime documentary, Surviving R. Kelly. Dream, great to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
Joining us from Boston, Massachusetts, Renee Graham. She's an associate editor and columnist for the Boston Globe. Previously, she wrote a weekly column for the Globe on pop culture and music. Renee, great to talk to you.
Hello, David.
Also joining us from Tempe, Arizona, is my old boss, Bill Wyman. He is, among other things, the former arts editor of Salon and the former assistant managing editor at NPR. His writing on the arts and media has appeared in many publications. And his latest, in BuzzFeed News, is How Did the Media Get the R. Kelly Story So Wrong? The New York Times led the way. Hiya, Bill.
Hey, David. How are you? Thanks for having me.
Of course. So let's start with you, Dream. You spent a lot of time. You produced a just searing six-hour documentary for Lifetime. Can you just distill for those of our listeners who may know R. Kelly's music but may not know the full story, distill what the case is against R. Kelly? Tell us what the accusations are that count.
Yeah. For nearly three decades, R. Kelly has built an ecosystem around his predation. He has been accused by woman after woman. Many of them were girls when they met him, teenagers or post-teenagers. And they have the exact same story from different periods in his life of not only being preyed upon, but being physically abused, of having their movement controlled, of being cut off from their families, of being refused food. So this is definitely the foundation for this work, for this docuseries, is Jim DeRogatis' heroic and relentless reporting. He broke the story the third week in December of 2000 and kind of never stopped. Mm-hmm. And of course, last year, in BuzzFeed, he published stories about where and what R. Kelly was doing in this very moment. And in 2019, there are two families still hoping to be in contact with their daughters, one of whom R. Kelly disappeared at 17 and the other at 19.
I want to play a clip of one of R. Kelly's super fans who he met when she was just 35 years old. Her name is Asante McGee. She was interviewed in your documentary. She started dating R. Kelly, and eventually she moved into his Atlanta house.
Before I actually met him personally, I guess because I was just so much of that fan, I just couldn't see him as being that monster. But now, actually being in that house and witnessing with my own eyes, I regret not listening and believing of the allegations that happened. There's a difference between R. Kelly and Robert. R. Kelly is this fun, laughing, loving guy. But Robert is the devil.
Dream Hampton, what was it like to speak of these women for your documentary?
It shook me to my core. I knew that this was going to be a dark story, and I don't think I knew how dark it would get. the parents in particular had a real desperation in the, I mean, at this point, there are no spoiler alerts. A lot of people have seen this. Mm-hmm. But in episode 5, we have an actual rescue. We flew a mother out to sit with us. We intended to interview her in the studio as we had the other parents. And she had seen a TMZ video and thought she might be able to find her daughter. And we had to follow her on that journey. We couldn't tell her to do anything. We always had legal breathing down our neck, which I appreciate it. And she literally gets her daughter out of a hotel where R. Kelly had kind of stashed her as he went to do a spot date. So, I mean, yeah, there was a spectrum of emotions, and we're still in it. We are still in touch with the two families who desperately want their two daughters back, the Clarys and the Savages.
Mm-hmm. Renee Graham, this is a story about a world-famous artist and these incredible allegations. They involve women like Asante McGee, who was 35. They also involve a lot of women who said that they were, you know, well underage when R. Kelly first went after them. The story starting in some ways in the public view when R. Kelly, then 27, marries the woman who becomes a pop star, Aaliyah, who is then 15 years old, although I think on the birth certificate that was lied. How did fans react to that and other developments that came into public view, the reporting by the Chicago Sun-Times, the police investigation? How did fans react to R. Kelly the artist and R. Kelly the man?
I don't think people make a distinction between R. Kelly the artist and R. Kelly the man, and that may be part of the problem. You know, there's a 6-year gap between when R. Kelly marries Aaliyah and when Jim DeRogatis' first story come out in the Chicago papers. It was kind of a joke. No one really took it seriously. People were kind of like, oh, wow, he married Aaliyah. She's only 15. But it never had any traction in the way that I thought it would. I assumed it would be like, you know, what it was in 1950s when Jerry Lee Lewis married his 13-year-old cousin. And mm-hmm. effectively, his career ended. You know, he continued to perform, but he never again reached the heights that he once had. That didn't happen at all with R. Kelly. He just kept putting music out. The music kept selling and the concerts kept selling. It almost felt like nobody cared. And then when the stories come out in Chicago papers about R. Kelly, there was this kind of people were sort of disgusted and annoyed. But it didn't really do anything to his career. And that's the thing I never quite understood. Like, you know, you had all of these details in this story about R. Kelly hanging out at McDonald's, hanging out at high schools, and picking up underage girls, and it never stopped his momentum as an artist. It was really disconcerting. But then you had to ask yourself why that was.
You know, I'm just looking at some of the details here. He's one of the best-selling music artists in the U.S. with over 30 million albums sold, listed by Billboard as the most successful R&B hip-hop artist of the years 1985 to 2010 and the most successful R&B artist in history. Bill Wyman, you've covered musical acts and figures for decades. How does this fit in the pantheon of scandal? Where does R. Kelly stand?
Well, it's in a way, I guess maybe there's been some people who murdered people, but it's uniquely awful. And the answer to the problem that we're all nagging with, I think, from my particular perch, is that the media sort of helped R. Kelly along in just one very specific way, which is just not telling readers and viewers what exactly the allegations were against him. And I hate to bring this up because I know there's people driving, you know, to work or home from work right now, but what we knew by the year 2000 or 2003 were that he filmed himself having sex with underage girls. It's very well known who the woman was and how old she was. And again, I hate to say this, but there's video of him urinating into her mouth and face. Number
and
one.
Indeed,
number two, right after that, he was arrested in Florida with a camera full of pictures of him having sex with other underage girls. And that case was thrown out on a legal technicality. Okay. So now, of course, every artist, every accused person deserves the right to be assumed innocent, et cetera, et cetera. But at the same time, there's a difference between someone accusing someone, a he said, she said, or what they call circumstantial evidence, and the fact that these videos and pictures exist out there and the obvious inferences you can draw from that. So I personally thought one of my pet peeves through the whole process is the media hasn't shared just this basic information with people, which could have helped change the trajectory of the way he's viewed by the public.
And I want to say his lawyer, Steve Greenberg, said to the AP this month, the allegations aren't true. He never knowingly had sex with an underage woman, never forced anyone to do anything, never held anyone captive, never abused anyone. I want to briefly go to Yellow Springs, Ohio. Carmen, you're on the air. Why do you think this happened?
Hi. You know, for me, kind of the elephant in the room, so to speak, is the fact that the things that, you know, that ties all this together is that all of the women and young girls that he victimized are women and young girls of color. So, you know, the Jerry Lee Lewis thing's a little different. He got shut down immediately because, you know, he married his younger cousin, but she was a little white girl, right? So the fact that this has been allowed to go on for so long without any repercussions for R. Kelly, and in fact, not only were there no repercussions, his career continued to skyrocket, is because these girls were black girls, you know, and it kind of speaks to the lack of value that this country has for girls and women of color.
Well, thank you for that call, Carmen. I appreciate it. Briefly, Renee Graham, how does that strike you as an explanation?
I think she's absolutely right. I can't believe that R. Kelly would have been allowed to get away with this if these were white girls and white women he was abusing. That's really the heartbreaking thing about this. You know, on one hand, yes, the media blew it. The media didn't get it wrong. The media just ignored it. But so did the public. You know, the people who were buying his records, they knew. You know, they heard the stories. They saw the jokes on Chappelle's show. They heard the jokes that Chris Rock made. You know, it became a punchline. That was the problem here.
And indeed, one of our listeners writes in on Twitter, Michael Downs asks, really, did no one at On Point Radio watch Chappelle's show in 2003? The question is, why we had turned a blind eye, not why his conduct escaped our attention. We'll be talking about race, we'll be talking about the media and more as we consider the case of R. Kelly and decades of allegations against him. You can join our conversation. Can we separate the art from the artist? Should be. How did he survive so long with all these allegations out there? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're talking about R. Kelly and the recent Lifetime documentary highlighting his alleged abuse of women. You can join the conversation. For R. Kelly fans, how do you feel about his music now? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm joined by Renee Graham. She's associate editor and columnist for the Boston Globe. Bill Wyman, the longtime music and arts journalist. And Dream Hampton. She's executive producer of the new Lifetime documentary, Surviving R. Kelly. I think it's worth hearing another voice from that documentary. Lizette Martinez met R. Kelly in 1995, just a year after he had married Aaliyah, who was then 15 years old. Lizette Martinez herself said she had sex with him when she was aged 17. Here she recounts living with R. Kelly.
I felt like a sex object. You know, he would say, I still want to help you with your career. Music was my joy. So I felt like my dreams are going to come true. I just kind of like listened to him and said, okay, you know, and stay there by myself. He would have people follow me because he told me as much. If you leave this hotel room or go anywhere, I have my boys following you and I know everything that you're doing. So I was very fearful. Wouldn't hear from him for days. And then he would come back and it was just sex and abuse and mental and physical abuse.
Dream Hampton, we have a listener who writes in, on Point Radio, the bottom line is that R. Kelly's behavior was ignored for as long as it was because we as a society don't value black girls. That question, again, raised by our earlier listener, Carmen. If these had been white girls, Sarah writes, they would have been more protected. In the reporting that you and your colleagues did for your documentary, how much evidence did you find to support that, or what did you conclude on that question?
Well, of course, I agree with Renee. I agree with the person who wrote in. I mean, it's one of the reasons that I approached and agreed to do this project, because we had a vision of centering the black women and Lizette, who is Latino, and centering them, not doing a biopic on R. Kelly. So it's very important for me that we hear and see them tell their stories, which is different than reading it. But I also, over the past year, obviously have been thinking deeply about this. And it's a little more complicated than that also. I mean, R. Kelly is someone who was able to do what he did because he operates under a series of closed and locked doors, often with the lock on the outside of the door in a very literal way. But metaphorically, that is also how he operates. That trial, so you have people now who can say, well, he was found not guilty, even though they know he's not innocent. And how was he found not guilty? Because the 14-year-old that he was abusing in the tape that Bill described refused to testify. She was still with him 10 years later when another one of our survivors, Kitty, you know, is in a relationship with him, and he introduces her to the girl who was 14 when he abused her in the tape, and at this point is 24 and still close to R. Kelly and in his life. So there was no one to testify against him. As Bill said, the Florida case fell apart on a technicality. There is a way that Chicago is not New York or L.A. So he was in his cloistered world, inviting women into this cloistered world and girls, and then throwing away the key once he locked them into these rooms. There were women who would be in the studio who didn't see each other, friends who had come as kind of fans of his and had agreed to have sex, even though they were teenagers and couldn't legally consent, and couldn't find each other in the house because it was that cordoned off. So I'm not giving fans like an excuse or letting them off the hook, but there has been a very complicated way that he has done what he does. He's built an entire ecosystem around it.
You know, it was interesting, just to be clear about the case that you're talking about. The Sun-Times prints its first allegations of sex with minors in late 2000. As you said, February 2002, the Chicago police revealed an investigation into alleged child pornography, which is what some years later, in 2008, he goes on trial for, rather than underage sex. Remind us, Bill Wyman, why it was that those were the charges he was, you know, as opposed to, say, statutory rape that he was pursued with.
Right. And you'd think that'd be the case. And there was actually, of course, a network of young girls who had been charging him with this. And these cases tend to get charges filed, or cases, civil cases, that he would settle out of court. So obviously he's settling a lot of these charges in the background. And the police were frustrated along the way because they couldn't get any of the victims to actual testify or the girls' parents. And one of the sad things about the girl in that one tape we're all talking about is that her parents worked with Kelly, and the media has been very reluctant to name them because when you identify the parents, you end up identifying the girl. But both of her parents were part of R. Kelly's inner circle. Okay,
but
so you had all these what are presumed to have been payoffs, and then so the prosecutors decided, okay, well, we can't get the victims on the stand. We can at least establish that this woman was underage by unbelievable testimonies. I had to say this in my story too, that they had a woman on the stand who says, yes, I know that's the woman because I had group sex with her and R. Kelly that was filmed as well. But they did not convince the jury, and of course, Kelly deserves to have that noted.
As well as his denials. Dream, go ahead. It sounded like you wanted to say something.
Yeah, I'm sorry to interrupt, Bill. I just wanted to note that her aunt, the singer, Sparkle, Stephanie Edwards, heroically did take the stand and identify her niece and say, so she had a family member that was advocating for her when she didn't know to advocate for herself and when her family was unwilling to advocate for her. And Sparkle you know, lost her entire career. She was a protege of R. Kelly's. He was writing songs for her. This is back when there was a music industry. The one video that, the two or three videos that she had were well over, they were six-figure budget videos. There was an investment in Sparkle. And she threw that away to stand up for her 14-year-old niece, who she, coming from a family of musicians and singers, had introduced to R. Kelly when the girl was only 12. Not in a, here's my niece, let me offer her up to you, but in an, I live in the studio, my niece is coming by, my brother plays bass on some of your, you know. I mean, yeah, he's right. Bill is right. It's complicated and it's sick often. And the girls were sacrificed, that girl in particular, not just by the public, but by sometimes the people closest to them who fail to protect them.
I want to take a call now from Baltimore, Maryland. Kelly, it sounds like you did watch the series. What did you take from it?
Thank you for taking my call. Yeah, I really enjoyed the docuseries. And the question that I walked away with is, what is it going to take to hold R. Kelly legally accountable? I think that we're seeing this moment of reckoning as a society that will no longer stand for it, but with the statute of limitations that exists around sexual abuse and assault charges in so many states, what is it going to take to get justice here?
All right. Well, thank you for that, Kelly. Anyone want to swing at that pitch? Bill, what do you think? There have been a couple of investigations launched, as I understand it, in the wake of the documentary and recent reporting from Jim on BuzzFeed, raising questions about whether or not he's forcing women to do things against their will. What do you see actually likely to be able to hold R. Kelly accountable?
It is very complicated because I think a lot of people like me were journalists, and in a way, I have to let the court system take its course. I accept it that a lot of these people get off on these big charges. R. Kelly, the most prominent. Bill Cosby obviously didn't. Someone like Roman Polanski obviously had to flee to escape punishment for these sorts of charges. So the system sometimes works, sometimes doesn't. And as a journalist, you can't kind of bemoan that or I guess you can, but that's not really my job. And I think it just comes back to all of us standing up as people, journalists doing their jobs and just insisting that the word R. Kelly, the words R. Kelly has to include a comma, who, blankety, blankety, blank. A really interesting test case, if I can go back to Roman Polanski, he was treated the same way.
Just to be clear, the famous director of Chinatown and so many other incredible movies.
Right, who was accused of having sex with a child back in the 70s and jumped on an SST overnight from L.A. right on the eve of being sentenced. And a lot of people sort of say, oh, he was a randy European and he fell afoul of American morality and stuff like that. Again, I hate to talk in an X-rated fashion, but what happened is that he found this 13-year-old girl. He isolated her in an empty mansion, gave her champagne, gave her a Quaalude and raped her and then anally raped her. That's what she told the police the next morning, right? And over the years, when you don't explain that to people, they think, oh, it's just sort of a little, she was 17 or something like that. And I think that the journalists need to kind of make people confront the facts of the case, and then we can debate it. And we don't sort of acclimate people to the sort of lack of precision that sort of really pays to the benefit of the celebrity, right? I mean, it kind of doesn't. It's part of if you're doing something that the PR team is high-fiving themselves about, journalists should question themselves. And I think that's the first step. And then people need to step up and say, hey, I'm not going to let my kids go to an R. Kelly concert, because you can imagine what goes on backstage at an R. Kelly concert. But he got to tour for 15 more years.
It seems to me that the story is an incredible, bouillabaisse of elements of race, of gender, of class, of money, of power, of fame. And, it's also now happening in a slightly different moment. It's the Me Too moment. In 2017, as I mentioned, there was reporting revealed that what appeared to be groups of young women living in R. Kelly's homes, families came out publicly and begged for their daughters to return home. Among the people interviewed for the Lifetime documentary was Tarana Burke. She's founder of the Me Too movement. And she said no one seemed to be listening to these families.
These families came forward and were making desperate pleas to get their children back, to get their daughters back home and away from R. Kelly. We've been watching them since they came forward in 2017, tried various attempts to get media attention, but it doesn't take hold. And again, I think that goes back into this idea that Black girls don't matter. They don't matter enough. And it's proven over and over again.
Renee Graham, we have kind of consensus today that on this discussion that young Black women and young Black girls weren't taken seriously enough in this case. How are we looking at this differently in light of the Me Too movement that Tarana Burke helped to launch?
Well, I think when the Me Too movement really sort of broke nationally and worldwide in late 2017, I think there was an idea that here was a moment when people needed to revisit R. Kelly. So if we were going to talk about predation and we were going to talk about sexual assault and men in positions of power, then how weren't we talking about R. Kelly? And so there was this sort of push to get his name back out there and start talking about what he's done, what he's been accused of, and the women who've accused him. The thing to remember is that, yes, I absolutely do believe that the public reception has been different because the victims have been women of color. But I also think it always brings us back to the idea of blaming women and victim blaming. And the fact that we heard this with Harvey Weinstein, we heard this with Bill Cosby, and we're hearing it again with R. Kelly, that somehow these girls and women, they wanted it, they forced themselves on, these men wouldn't have to rape these women because they're famous, they can get any woman they want. You know, that narrative never really goes away. And so you have to really even go back, you know, separate the two. You know, society doesn't care about women, but society really, really doesn't care about Black women. And so you sort of put those two things together, and it was almost like a story made to be ignored. You know, one thing we haven't really talked about yet is, you know, we've talked about the media, but we haven't really talked about the fans. Yeah. And the fact that, you know, and it needs to be said, R. Kelly's fan base is Black. You know, I don't know a lot of white people listen to R. Kelly, and I certainly don't know a lot of Black men who listen to R. Kelly. So I would say the bulk of R. Kelly's fan base is Black women. And so what do you do with that? What do you do when you go to these shows and you look, you see these clips and you see all of these women screaming for R. Kelly 25 years after we first started to hear accusations about his mistreatment of women and girls? You know, that's really heartbreaking when you think about it. And I think that's as complicated in this as any aspect of this case.
Renee Graham, you know, he obviously earned the nicknames the King of R&B, the King of Pop Soul. He sold. He won 3 Grammys for I Believe I Can Fly and had more top 40 hits than any other male solo artist in the 1990s. You mentioned his fan base, mostly African-Americans, mostly female fans, often very young female fans at that, as we saw in this documentary and have seen over the years. There's an element of race, though, that one of our callers raised, which was a question of him as a Black man under attack and under accusation. How did the sense of him being embattled play out among prominent African Americans and among African American institutions as over the years?
Well, you know, I think there is this sense because, you know, look at the history of this country and what's been done to Black people, what's been done to Black men, and this idea that they're always being torn down, they're always being accused, and they're always being attacked. So if you're within that community, I think there's an instinct to want to protect them from that. And I think Jim DeRogatis made a very interesting point in a recent interview where he said he thinks the reason why a lot of people ignored his reporting is because he called himself a fat white guy. And that immediately people felt like, oh, it's this white man going after our great Black idol. You know, that's, you know, the history of this country is what it is, but, you know, it doesn't mean that every single person has to be uplifted. And if you have someone within your community who's harming your community, which is exactly what R. Kelly has been doing for decades, I think you have to let that person go. There's no point in defending that person.
Mm-hmm. Dream Hampton, we only have a couple minutes left before the end of this segment of the show. But there was this thing that I read in preparing for this in which one of his R. Kelly's former aides is talking to a records executive, and the record executive says, okay, before we sign the contract, is there anything to some of these accusations? What about that tape? And referring, I believe, to the tape in which he's urinating on a young woman, on an underage woman. And the aide says, have you seen it? And the record executive says, no. And the aide says, I haven't either. If I did, I wouldn't be able to work for him. How much of this industry was based on willfully looking away?
Well, I think that we have done that historically with so many of our public figures. And I didn't want us to be able to do that anymore. I wanted his fans, who, as Renee said, are us, are Black women. My mentions on Twitter would also tell you that plenty of Black men are fans of his, or at least coming to his defense in this moment. And he's a 51-year-old R&B singer. So his fate was, at this point, to kind of slip into irrelevance. He has been holding on and doing spot dates, and there's been heroic work by organizers like Mute R. Kelly, who have tried to deny him some of this income to create a kind of professional death. And I think that that work is legitimate, and I believe in Black girls and Black women.
You're hearing the voice there of Dream Hampton. She's executive producer of the new Lifetime documentary, Surviving R. Kelly, as well as the columnist and Boston Globe editor, Renee Graham, and Bill Wyman, the music journalist. We're discussing R. Kelly and the sexual abuse allegations against him and our society's reaction to what we've learned. You can join our conversation. What's your question for our guest today? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik, and we're having an upsetting and I think important conversation today, this hour. We're discussing R. Kelly and the decades of sexual abuse claims against him. You can join our conversation. Did the recent documentary on Lifetime cause you to rethink your support of R. Kelly? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. My guests today are Dream Hampton, executive producer of the new Lifetime documentary, Surviving R. Kelly, Renee Graham, associate editor and columnist for the Boston Globe, and Bill Wyman, a music and arts journalist who's written about R. Kelly and the coverage of him by the press as recently as this week. I want to start the segment with just a reminder of the human element. One of the incredible things about documentary was bringing these accusers, these women who say they've been mistreated by R. Kelly, to life as individuals, as people. Joycelyn Savage was 19 years old when she began a relationship with R. Kelly. Her parents claimed their daughter has been brainwashed by the singer and is being held captive. Her father, Tim Savage, told WBUR's podcast Edge of Fame last year they've only had a handful of short phone conversations with their daughter, and occasionally the phone rings. It's R. Kelly himself, and he won't put their daughter on the phone.
We don't have no proof of life. And when you understand you have no proof of life, that's just like burying somebody in the ground. I talked to Mr. Kelly on March the 1st of 2018, you know, and he told me that trust the process to see my daughter. How can you tell a father that haven't seen his daughter in over 2 years, to trust the process? You mean to tell me to trust the process to see my own baby girl?
We're getting a lot of response from listeners about this, and I want to take a call now from Cleveland, Ohio. Jeff, what do you make of how long R. Kelly has been just going on, despite all of these accusations?
Well, I think this is an unfortunate circumstance of lack of information, lack of awareness, and to some degree, a function of class. I listened to NPR for the last 30 years. I never remember hearing anything about R. Kelly. I mean, my métier is classical music, and I didn't know who R. Kelly is until I saw the Lifetime special. And I also get a New York Times news feed. Now, why didn't I hear about R. Kelly before this courageous group of women put on this documentary? That's part one. Part two, so that's the information. And the awareness, you know, you can't force people to be aware, even though you give them the information. And I think that was another failure from the late 1990s until just recently. Mm-hmm. And so I also fault the jury, because I don't think they had all the information. I don't think they were aware. And I fault the record label. You can't tell me that they didn't have more awareness. I mean, he was too much of a cash cow.
Jeff, it sounds a little bit like the murder on the Orient Express. You feel like there's a lot of guilt to assign to a lot of different players here.
Right.
Okay. So let's throw this to Bill Wyman, because, Bill, this is in your wheelhouse. You've written this week about this very question, about the information that Jeff raised in that important point that he made there, the information being gotten out by journalists. And, in fact, you assign in some ways, as did the caller, some responsibility to the New York Times and a journalist who for a while was its chief music critic, Khalifa Saneh, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. But you say that there was this almost – willful minimization or somehow sidelining of R. Kelly's behavior in writing about him as a player in the musical scene.
Yeah, and I think it's really fair actually to point this particular finger, because the New York Times is the New York Times. Even more than today, the New York Times is a cultural arbiter, particularly in the arts and music and, of course, theater and movie world, that what the Times covered and what it didn't cover was a signal to everyone else. And I wrote about this at the time, and it outraged me then and still does now, how systematically – and again, I want to make it clear, I'm not jumping up and down about this. I'm not saying this gleefully. I'm just saying factually – story after story talked about what a genius he was, how irrepressible he was, how he was this bad boy and a freak. And it would kind of say, oh, and there was this thing about a videotape, but let's talk about how he's overcome that. He's more respected than he ever has been. He's triumphed over all these scandals.
Almost as though the scandal were a physical impediment or a disease or some sort of personal tragedy, as opposed to something that was as a result, at least allegedly, of his own behavior.
Of his own actions. Exactly. And it was all part of the celebrity narrative. The celebrity confronts a challenge and overcomes it. And this was before he even went on trial. Okay. And it was – you could almost make an intellectual argument for it after he was acquitted. But certainly before, it really created this PR world in which he could continue.
About his publicist. Well, first of all, the caller was from Cleveland, and there they had the Cleveland Orchestra's concertmaster, William Purcell, you know, was accused of like sexual harassment too, sexually harassing students, right? And mm-hmm. it exists in this little corner of people who care about classical music, as he said he does. And in that way, we have seen this segregated, what Renee talked about earlier. His fan base is black. He had one breakthrough song, I Believe I Can Fly. And there was this way that people who did write about him, these places like the New York Times, don't always employ music journalists and critics who have any stake in the community, in the black community. So it's just another story that they cover. They're not deeply invested in what happens to this community or even what's being said in this community. And I'm not saying that what was being said in this community was to throw R. Kelly away. In barbershops across America, for instance, when that abuse tape circulated, it went viral on the streets. People weren't always condemning him. I think Chappelle is a mixed bag, but then you had Aaron Magruder, who was a little more clear in his condemnation and in his mm-hmm. satirical condemnation. But
the author of The Boondocks.
Exactly, who did a really great, you know, episode on that. But I just wanted to throw in that this architect of his PR was a publicist who was with him forever, Regina Daniels, who defended him, who came up with all, you know, the strategy that Bill is talking about, that put forth this idea of him as this triumphant, you know, black man who was, you know, shaking off all of these ill-found charges. She then had her own daughter, who R. Kelly had known as a child. You know, he slept with her daughter at 18, and right. They finally had a falling out. His predation really knows no limits. And it wasn't until it happened to her own child, which sadly is the myopic way so many of us live our lives, that it's not until it directly affects us, whether you're talking about you're living in your corner with your classical music, you are a fan whose daughter hasn't yet, you know, come across R. Kelly, or he hasn't come across her. But yeah, Regina Daniels is public. You know, she was his publicist, and her daughter, her stepdaughter, she and George Daniels had known R. Kelly since she was in middle school. And the moment she turned 18, because at some point he did start to, you know, have some sense about like not wanting to settle all these lawsuits and started preying on 18 and 19 year olds. As soon as she turned 18, he began sleeping with her.
If I can just inject something really quickly.
Yes, of course, Renee Graham.
I think it was really interesting when Dream was talking about how a lot of people don't react to it until it directly affects them. And I think that's been the impact of surviving R. Kelly. It literally took these stories and these women and put them in our homes. We couldn't ignore it in the same way that we could if we didn't read that newspaper or see that piece online. Here it was sort of night after night, hour after hour, and that's why we're talking about that. In a way, it's tragic because nothing is different in a way now than it was a year ago. But we're right. talking about right. this because we watched it. And it caught fire, and it made people talk about this situation that they'd normalized so long ago. You know, there was a story in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution in 2016 talking about an R. Kelly upcoming album and his Christmas tour, and even asked him his holiday songs. And the allegations were reduced to a line that said, Kelly has also endured his share of scandal. That was it. Wow. That was all it said.
That's incredibly typical, too, of coverage.
Right.
Of him
that normalization. And what surviving R. Kelly has done has forced us to drop that and deal with these issues directly.
You know, it reminds me a little bit of the coverage of Ray Rice, the still of the picture of him dragging by the hair his then fiance out of the elevator in New Jersey casino after knocking her unconscious. The leak says you're suspended two games, when videotape is leaked to TMZ of him actually cold cocking her and knocking her unconscious in that thing. And it's you can see the video of it. Suddenly the league moves swiftly and bans him for life. The power of video amplifying greatly the kind of reporting done by Jim DeRogatis and his colleagues at the Sun-Times and BuzzFeed. You know, tremendous reporting, but this really brings it all together. I think it's important to acknowledge, you know, R. Kelly you know, denies this in 2017 in response to a movement of Time's Up, saying that people like him should no longer be allowed to be stars, given the accusations. The statement by his people said, R. Kelly supports the pro-women goals of Time's Up movement. We understand criticizing a famous artist is a good way to draw attention to those goals. In this case, it is unjust and off target. We will vigorously resist this attempted public lynching of a black man who has made extraordinary contributions to our culture. We have a call here from Baltimore, Maryland. Carl, tell us your thoughts about R. Kelly and about these accusations.
Hi, good day to everyone. I just think that more time needs to be spent on removing the myopic view of the fan base. And I guess I should have led with I'm a black male, African-American male. I've seen this for years. I've seen the R. Kelly, you know, just I've seen it escalate over the years. And it went from him being the R&B boogeyman to as soon as some fans meet him, all of that stuff goes out of the window. And he's not kidnapping anybody. People are being basically brought to him. And they already know what the deal is with him. Our fan base is what fuels this guy. If you take away the fan base, I think it was said earlier that there aren't a whole lot of people that aren't black females that are really pushing him. So how do we get to them to show them, look, no, this is real. This isn't made up. Nobody's trying to tear R. Kelly down. Nobody's trying to, you know, do a lynching of his character or anything. He did these things. He's doing these things. How do we drive that point home?
Thank you for that, Carl. Let's throw that. What do you say, Renee Graham? How do you drive that home?
I don't know. I mean, you know, I'm hoping that this documentary, which people are still talking about, that's still having an impact, will force people to look at that. I mean, I hope people understand that every time they stream his music or download his music or buy a concert ticket, they're helping fund what, you know, Dream really eloquently called this ecosystem of predation. And so I'm hopeful that this will be that moment. I've thought that before. I thought that when he married Aaliyah, I thought that when Jim DeRogatis' story came out about, you know, the quote-unquote sex cult in 2017, I always think that's the moment. Maybe it comes now because, as I said, these women and their harrowing stories were in our homes. And maybe that, you know, maybe that makes a sea change. We'll see.
There are efforts to try to do just that. The summer of 2017, there was a hashtag movement, Mute R. Kelly, which began. Co-founder Oronike Odeleye explains in the documentary they had very simple intentions.
The goals of Mute R. Kelly in the beginning were very humble. It was, let's get him off Atlanta radio. And let's get his concerts canceled. I thought that that would be a really kind of simple ask with the 25 years of receipts that we have against this person, and that was met with resounding silence. You know, the radio stations would not respond, would not call me back.
So, and subsequently, you've seen some figures like Tom Joyner say he's not going to play R. Kelly anymore, and some artists, both in the documentary and outside of it, had said, you know, I made a mistake in collaborating with him in the past, or, you know, I'm not going to support him in the future. One question I have, Dream Hampton, is about how much of this played out in public view. That is, you know, R. Kelly didn't totally hide his interest in sex. He didn't hide his he was asked frequently about young women and kind of played it off as, well, you know, I'm only interested in 19-year-olds, but I wouldn't be interested in younger women. And yet, you know, he married a girl who should have been probably a sophomore in high school at the time. How much of this was really there to be known regardless of how concrete the accusations were?
Well, I hope that we laid it out in a way that, and I think that we did, and thank you, Renee, for saying that, a relentless way, 6 hours, that we thought maybe we had 2 hours, then we knew we had four, and then we realized we had six. And we stacked these stories. We knew we had to cooperate. We know that people, as Renee said, don't believe women and definitely don't believe black women. They blame them for, as the caller said, and I appreciate his call, but I do understand that point of view that these women kind of give themselves, and even more nefariously, they believe that their families give themselves to R. Kelly. But I had a lot of empathy for the parents who believed selectively in the criminal justice system in this moment, that he was found not guilty, and maybe there were just rumors, and they live way down in Florida, and they didn't know every single thing. They didn't know about Sparkle's testimony. They didn't know that the judge didn't allow other evidence about settled lawsuits to go into the case. The judge wouldn't allow the fact that he'd married Aaliyah to go into the case. And then there's this complicated thing about the truth of our own families and our own lives. My father, when he was 37, you know, married a 19-year-old. My grandfather married, you know, down in the South, my grandmother when she was 15 and he was 26. So many of us have, the Aaliyah story was one we just weren't sure. Was this Elvis Presley marrying Priscilla? Jerry Lee Lewis, we found that to be disgusting on a number of levels. Was this a rock and roll story?
Right.
Like Jimmy Page, who continues, you know, well into his old age. It wasn't just the 14-year-old back in the day. So there was this way that we had to create a tapestry to show that not only has this been behavior that he has been, that this has been his behavior for almost three decades, but that it's escalated.
Well, and one of the most haunting things in your documentary in some ways, the young girl, high schooler, who went out to cheer him on during his trial for child pornography ended up being one of the young women he cultivated and, according to her, that he had sex with underage. You've been hearing there the voice of Dream Hampton, writer and filmmaker and executive producer of the recent Lifetime documentary Surviving R. Kelly. Dream, so glad you could join us for this hour.
Thank you.
Renee Graham is associate editor and columnist for the Boston Globe. Renee, my great thanks.
Thanks so much, David.
We've also heard from Bill Wyman, music journalist and former arts editor at Salon and NPR. Bill, thanks so much.
Thank you, David.
Make sure to continue our conversation online or get the On Point podcast or website, onpointradio.org. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.